Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast looking back on the year that changed everything apart from the government. My name's Corey Hazelhurst, and I stole that opening line from Hugo Rifkin. But thankfully, I'm joined by four people with original thoughts to assess the last year in British politics. We have the strong and stable chair of Birmingham Fabians, Luke John Davis.
Yeah.
Councillor for the many, not the few in Shard End, John Cotton.
Hiya.
The deputy leader of Birmingham City Council, who's building a city that works for everyone, Bridget Jones.
Hello.
We have, of course, Changing Britain's Future is my partner in propaganda, Steve Haynes.
Hey, Corey.
Changing Britain's Future was the Lib Dem slogan in the election. I had to look that up because I didn't know what it was. Make of that what you will. So in this episode, we're looking back on the last year in British politics with a sense of excitement and puzzlement, and for me at least, a small dollop of fear that by the time this episode goes out, the government will have completely collapsed and the whole episode will be rendered meaningless. In April, Theresa May called a general election, which is fair to say backfired somewhat. And that's what we're going to reflect on after some music. Who weren't present in our bunker for the post-election episode in June. So I'll come to you first. One book that was published this year was Ed Balls' memoirs, and he said that in politics, you should always try and question your assumptions. We met in April for a pre-election discussion, and we basically said that Labour were doomed, even if some of us were too polite to admit it. Yet Labour gained seats in June. So what assumptions did we make in April that turned out to be wrong?
I think we assumed nothing had changed. And we hadn't really paused to consider that everything had changed. So in the short amount of time since 2015, the leaders of both major parties had changed, and most significantly Brexit had happened. And the young people's vote had gone from being something it was safe to ignore in 2015, not my opinion, of course, but something that a lot of people had assumed, to something that was absolutely vital. Years of screwing over young people in domestic policy had come home to roost. So tuition fees, the minimum wage, the living wage rather, not applying to under 25s, and changes to housing benefit, all of that had come home. And then, of course, Brexit and the fact that a younger generation felt completely betrayed by an older generation. I think all of that combined to create a wave of enthusiasm and anger that none of us had quite seen coming.
I think one of the other points that it's important to talk about there, though, is like when we talk about young people, we tend to almost envision your 20-somethings, and certainly that's the kind of the image that the media and the Tories seem to have gone with, and I think Labour's played into this up to this as well. Whilst that was certainly part of it, when you look at the demographics of who voted Labour, it was also that it was people who you wouldn't necessarily count as young in general, but in politics and demographics, they still are. You've got people in their 30s going up toward into their 40s who also just broke away from the Tories. Because, and again, this is one of the things that we I think everybody missed, people had started to get a bit fed up of austerity and seeing various systems not funded properly and things not working.
So you need to remember that I'm a local councillor and the average age of a local councillor is 60. So because of my working environment, sometimes my internal perception of what constitutes young is skewed somewhat compared to what most other people will consider. So I was including all those demographics in my comments, even if it may not be apparent to the real world army.
I think the other thing that you need to bear in mind is the young have always voted progressively, and then most people will go on a certain journey through life as they get more and more centrist or right wing or however you want to describe it. And the reasons for that have started to disappear. People moved towards the centre as job security became important to them, so the economy became important to them. Housing became important to them because their mortgage was important to them. Education became important to them because they started having children. Now, children is happening later on, and that's partly sort of sociological changes, but also partly the fact that people can't afford to have them as young as they used to. You now get a house when your parents die and leave it to you, in essence. It's really hard to get on the housing ladder. The other situation is that people don't have a secure job anymore. You don't go into a company as an apprentice and leave with a clock at 65. So all these kind of social factors that moved people towards the Conservatives themselves, through the changes that Thatcher made, have cut off. So they've just completely cut off the reasons to vote Conservative.
Well, they've also cut off the reasons to vote UKIP.
Mm.
So a lot of the returning vote to Labour came from UKIPers who had lost their reason to vote UKIP because the single issue party had achieved its single issue.
The volatility of the electorate, I think, was underestimated. So maybe a lot of that social fact, I mean, attachment of voters to a particular party has stopped. There's a lot of voter churn now, which makes polling very difficult, but also makes campaigning very difficult as well. One thing I'm sure we'll talk about, but basically we wrote off Jeremy Corbyn. We didn't think he'd have as good a campaign as he had. I think we underestimated the fact that actually he'd had two national leadership elections to test himself when Theresa May hadn't been tested, and I think that was a big factor. I think the other thing, we assumed that the Tories wouldn't call a snap election without having made so little preparation for it. So, John, when in June you talked about how the fact that May had lost her majority maybe shed new light on the decision of Gordon Brown not to call a snap election in 2007, and maybe that decision seems better in hindsight than it was, do you think May was right to go to the electorate in April?
I think on the rules as how we thought they operated in April, it was a perfectly sensible decision to take. You're 20 points ahead in the polls. You've got a major opposition party that everybody has agreed is heading for an absolute tanking when an election's called. You've got difficult Brexit negotiations ahead, so you want a majority to be able to deliver your version of what that looks like. And also, you want to change the timing of the election cycle so the next general election doesn't happen slap-bang in the middle of the Brexit process. So it made absolute sense to do that. And then you also got the sense that they were looking at the fracturing Labour coalition as they saw it and thinking, right, we can make a real play, particularly for the traditional working class votes. And you could argue that we saw some of that play out with what then happened in the actual election results, with the losses of places like Stoke South and Walsall North. But on its own merits, back in April, that was an absolutely sensible, practical decision to take. Of course, what they hadn't factored for was what then subsequently happened in terms of their lack of preparation. The fact that you can't run an election campaign on the basis the leader is strong and stable and the focus of the campaign, which is clearly none of those things. The other thing is, using history as a guide has been proved to perhaps be a false approach, because it's so clear that a number of fundamentals had so drastically changed. We ended up in the world that I think none of us were really expecting when we saw that exit poll just after 10 o'clock on the 8th of June.
Yeah, I think one of the core assumptions that everybody made, which turned out to be completely false, was that the Tories would be competent at actually arranging an election in a way that would actually benefit them. This goes to their planning beforehand, the fact that everybody was seemingly written off the idea that there was going to be a snap election, and then Theresa May changes her mind in the middle of a walking holiday in Wales, halfway up like a mountain. The entirety of the manifesto was basically written by Nick Timothy without any real buy-in from anyone else. You then got a complete lack of proper kind of messaging strategy beyond "let's put Theresa May out there." All of those things were clearly mistakes, and some of them were just mistakes in general, even if we weren't in a different place as to where we thought, like not consulting with your cabinet over policies and things like that. That's just a rookie error, which it seems that they made, and no one really thought that was likely to be the case.
I think there was a certain amount of arrogance from Nick Timothy and Fernandez on that. But I think also the actual stuff that they came out with was shocking. They refused to cost anything, which, you know, was always going to come back and cause some issues. And your main point is that we balance the books and they can't, but we're not going to tell you how we're going to do that. They ought to have known that the way it was portrayed in the media, and essentially the way it was written, was, okay, we've got two policies. We're going to maim small animals and we're going to take grandma's house away.
Yeah, and those that came out of confidence, I think. So Tories got a bit blindsided by it and scrabbled together their strategy and went for it. Labour, I mean, you're right. We tested Corbyn in two national elections. it turns out that having this torturous, painful process where we take half a year to elect a leader actually pays off in that you're remarkably well practiced at running elections. So we thought, sod it. We pulled together our candidates at really short notice. We came out with a compromise manifesto, which actually turned out to be a really, really good bit of work. And I think there was clearly a lot of sod in it in our approach. So the moment Jeremy Corbyn turned up to the debate, they clearly had a sod it moment. Let's do this. What have we got to lose? And it paid off. Whereas the Tories lacked that confidence. They lacked that sod it moment. They lacked the ability to go out there and have some balls and put something good across.
Both campaigns, actually the leaders are quite similar. Both are politicians who have been ignored by the leadership of their particular party, both of whom wanted to do things very differently to the previous administration. So I think it's pretty obvious Jeremy Corbyn's already down with Tony Blair and New Labour. It's interesting reading Fallout at the moment, the Tim Shipman book. A lot of the decisions that were made in the election and as Theresa May was governing is because, well, we can't do that because David Cameron did it. So there wasn't a big letter from economists saying we back the Tories' plans rather than Labour because that's what George Osborne did and that kind of thing. I go back to the first podcast we did at the start of this year, Steve, and we did New Year's resolutions for party leaders. And I look back at what we said Jeremy Corbyn's was, and one of his was to get a proper media strategy and fire Seamus Milne out of the cannon. The other thing was to develop popular and logical policies. Theresa May's was to stop being a control freak and get a Brexit plan. It's interesting that actually Corbyn's media team, I think, have been quite good at, for all of his limitations as a leader, he's become a much more effective communicator, performer, a much more effective leader. They've almost made the best of his strengths and tried to play down his limitations a little bit. If anything, the election campaign seemed to play up the worst bits of Theresa May's and almost catastrophically eliminated all the strengths that she had.
The arrogance of the Conservatives' argument is an important one, that the whole approach to that election was around that we can't possibly lose this. So, you know, that whole issue around policies that were basically designed to kick some of their own staunch supporters, that comes out of a place of, well, you've got nowhere else to go. And clearly, they have got somewhere else to go as it then shaped up. You then also saw, I think, that arrogance in terms of their approach to, well, Corbyn is just so easily beatable. He'll be out on a public stage. He'll be out of something being grilled by Paxman and Dimble, be it by studio audiences, and will just fall apart. And frankly, that didn't happen either. It was a very assured performance, I thought, in some of those. But political nerds like ourselves are obsessed by this all the time. For lots of people out there, that's probably their first encounter in a meaningful sense with what they saw of Corbyn. And they saw something that was credible, seemed authentic, was different to identity politicians. So I think that broke through. There was a receptiveness to that kind of approach that may not have been there previously. The other thing that just occurs to me is we've waited years and years for the arrival of the first elections determined by the internet. And actually, I think this actually happened in 2017. It just came across being out on doorsteps and just being conscious that you were targeting people who were traditional voters, who we got voter ID information going back for some years, they appeared on mark registers. We were going out and having conversations with those people on the doorsteps, but completely missing the fact that there were younger members of our household who were upstairs who don't answer doors, who don't engage with politics in that way, but there's a whole set of things happening on Facebook and elsewhere that then spilled out into this sort of like explosion of we want change, we want something different. I think that's changes the context in how elections are going to operate going forward as well. And those of us who have been doing this for some time really need to, I suppose, get with the moment, if you like, and understand the different new ways of doing things.
Put your final facts away, John.
What you said about like 2017 being the first real internet election, I'm 100% in agreement with that. And you can see that now, both the Tories and the Labour have kind of tweaked this in some form and have started to try and adapt their strategies to allow for more kind of social media elements. So when you look at PMQs like over the past few months, like an awful lot of Jeremy Corbyn's questions, when you're watching it live or watching the videos of it, are quite rambling, and they're not a traditional way of doing PMQs. And in that moment, you watch it and you go, "This looks a bit naff. It's not very good." And Theresa May's taken to kind of doing similar things in response and just kind of going off on tangents and just spending a minute talking about a topic and kind of laying into Labour. Both of those things look really bad when you're viewing it live, When you put it on social media as a separate snippet and a cutout, though, suddenly you've got a piece of content which you can use to get out to your followers. And I think that's something that clearly the political parties have started noticing and are paying attention to.
I think, to go back to one of the points I made previously, Labour put a lot more effort into social media this time around. And I think especially Nick Timothy, Fiona Hill, didn't put a lot of effort into online campaigning on Facebook and Twitter because it was seen as being a bit gimmicky David Cameron.
I think that's a really good point about the power of editing. But I don't think we would have done so well in that election if we'd known it was coming. So because we were caught on the hoof, Jeremy essentially had no choice but to go out there and be himself. So because we were caught on the hoof, we didn't have time to come up with a focus group to Death Manifesto. We didn't have time to polish everything to the point where it's meaningless, which I think, to be fair, we did to an extent in 2015. So if you look at how Ed Miliband has performed since 2015, the guy's fantastic. He has been going down brilliantly on the radio. He's been going down brilliantly on TV. And it's because he's got the space and the confidence to be himself. And we haven't been there polishing him up. We haven't been, as a party, scared of letting him be himself. He's been a man transformed. When I say transformed, really, it's a man just allowed to show what he really is. And I think with Corbyn, because we didn't have the time to do all of that, he went out, he was authentic, and it really, really paid off.
I think that's true. I think also what we saw in this election was it was finally the one that broke the power of the traditional media. And again, you are kind of constrained by your own history, aren't you? So I think for a long time we'd seen what had happened, particularly happened to Neil Kinnock in the 9 years he was leader. He was absolutely pummeled by the Sun, the Mail, and all of those tabloid papers. And you know, it happened to 14 in the run-up to 83. And I think we looked at that and assumed that that same thing was going to happen again. And indeed, they were playing out all of those tropes. But it doesn't have the power when people are going off and manufacturing their own, and getting their own media and getting information in very different ways. A real lesson there for how we manage campaigning from now on. And it isn't about just having to play to those narrow interests.
I think what's interesting is that even after the election, Corbyn's continued going down that route. So I think, for instance, was it this week Morgan Stanley put out a report saying that a Corbyn government will be a threat to everything we hold dear and children and nannies and stuff. Previous Labour opposition, if you think about Ed Miliband or Tony Blair, would have tried to look credible and reasonable. No, we're not a threat, we're what have you. Whereas Corbyn said, yes, we are a threat. We are a threat to these bankers and to these crony capitalists and what have you, which is a very, very different approach. And it's an approach, I think, that works in the internet age, wouldn't necessarily have worked 20 years ago, but it's being unencumbered by self-doubt. And I think the thing with Ed Miliband's leadership was there was a lot of self-doubt, and the self-doubt kind of was the white noise that crowded off everything else. But LJ, after the election, tried to paint the election campaign as somehow a contrast between that kind of populism, Labour's populism, and the attempt of the Tories to have a grown-up campaign. So they were trying to solve problems like social care and what have you. And you had some people, I think people like John Mental, saying it means that politicians can't be honest now with the electorate. How far do you agree with that kind of framing of it?
The manifesto that looks good in 140 characters came out best. Now, whether you think the Tory manifesto was looking at solving things in a grown-up way, maybe not so sure. Labour's manifesto was the 2015 manifesto with a couple of hard left tropes of our nationalisations thrown in and a few this sounds like a good idea policies that got chucked in there, which had really, really good headlines, looked fantastic on Twitter, but if you actually drilled into them, had no real substance to them. The tuition fees one is the obvious example. As the manifesto stood, that would have bankrupted half to two-thirds of the universities in this country. But the headline was what mattered, because the headline was what got onto Twitter. The headline was what got into GIFs. The headline is what got tweeted around and put on out there to discuss on Facebook. And I think because it was so empty, everyone could kind of do what they always do with Corbyn, because Corbyn always speaks in very broad strokes. He is not a detailed person, shall we say, which is to put their own spin on what he said, or put their own priorities into that blank space. So, you know, when he said we will find a way to deal with historic student debt, those of you who had student debt would go, brilliant, that means that I'm going to get this, all this money wiped away, even though probably it wouldn't.
But I suppose in the old days we call that triangulation.
And that comes back to my earlier point. Everything's changed since 2015. Brexit was run one on empty promises and complete bollocks, if we're honest, that unraveled within hours of the result being announced. Did it stop it happening? Nope.
Not, yeah, well, vote leave is perhaps not the best model to go with, given what's happened when they tried to put it into practice.
But this is the thing. The public aren't necessarily scrutinising things, I think, in the way they did previously. I'm not saying that's a good thing.
No.
But it did give us the space, to an extent, to come out with some of the... some policies that haven't been developed to an extent that they might have been done had we had more of a lead into the election, and that not be a problem in the way it might have been a problem in previous elections.
The other thing is that that should have been the job of the traditional media. The traditional media was far too busy trying to get Theresa May elected for large parts of it, and those parts of it that weren't, you know, Guardian, Independent, Statesman, whatever, they were alienated by the Corbyn machinery, people like Seamus Mill and so on, not trusting the traditional Labour outlets. But what you've then got is the rise of, I don't want to say fake news, although Ipsa has called at least Squawkbox fake news, but these online media outlets do not see scrutiny and the public good and the competence, I suppose, or as their job. They see themselves as cheerleaders of a movement rather than as journalists who are looking for objective truth. And I think that's something that's going to be very important going forward. This is where you have this kind of cultural stuff. You have two bubbles screaming at each other in 140 characters, 280 characters now, rather than a discussion. Because, you know, there isn't the sort of, you know, the New York Times and the Washington Post, as it were, putting out these kind of, well, you know, have you thought about this thing that would have happened if you'd done that? You know, or how are you actually going to define your terms when you say deep? Yeah. To go back to Susan Fees as the example, when Jeremy Corbyn said, we will deal with historic student debt, if someone had said to him, how? Just that one word, how? How are you going to do this? What are you actually proposing you are going to do? It would have fallen apart. Because he didn't actually have anything to back it up. Similarly, with Theresa May's manifesto, when everything she did was uncosted, and if they literally said to her, how are you going to do this? How are you costing it? That could have fallen apart. Well, it did fall apart.
Well, actually, the interesting thing with the costings is that, actually, according to Four Lines anyway, the manifesto was costed, it was cost neutral, but they took the decision not to publish it. And I think, again, that's just a measure of their overconfidence. Mm. They didn't think they needed to do that. And I think Labour took the view, well, let's just have a manifesto. Let's put lots of nice things in it. If the IFS come out and say, well, actually, it'll cost £4 trillion, no one will really care because no one really believes in experts much anyway anymore. I get the impression, even back at the time and the conversations we've had since, the big turning point, I think, in the campaign was the manifesto. It was the publishing of the social care policy and then the new turn on it. But I think what's really interesting, if you read format and look through the account, is almost the chaoticness of the Tory campaign and the dysfunctionality, if that's the word, of the Tory campaign, almost means that something like that was inevitable. In that Tim Shipman says that he spoke to, I believe, about 30 Tory campaign aides, none of whom could give a straight answer to the question who was in charge of the campaign. You had Nick Timothy and Fiona Hill, who... Nick Timothy wanted to basically redefine the meaning of conservatism in the election, which is an interesting strategy. I think the point with the manifesto is, the manifesto is to win the election, not necessarily to govern. You've got then Lynton Crosby and Mark Texler, who the consultants brought in because they won in 2015. The difference between this election and 2015 is, in 2015, Crosby had 4 years to prepare for that. He had 4 years, he worked with Cameron really, really closely. May wasn't really spoken to by Crosby in that kind of detail at all. You also had Patrick McLaughlin, the party chairman, who was also meant to be setting up something. But the Tory ground campaign was really, really terrible, partly because they've not got as many members as we have, partly also because there was the campaign bus in 2015, but that ended up in financial irregularities. There was the tragic suicide of an activist. So there wasn't really a grand game from the Tories of people going around those key seats. Also, the amount of policy negotiations and announcements that happened on the hoof. So even the launch of the manifesto, you had BBC producers in tears to Fiona Hill the night before the Tories were organising their manifesto, because they hadn't got a building sorted to launch the manifesto in yet the night before. They talked about maybe having it at an RAF kind of museum in Bradford. And then someone pointed out, oh, well, if it's a Brexit election, do we really want to be announcing the manifesto when this Spitfire is up in the air? And someone thought that might be a little bit unfortunate. So it ended up being a random place in Halifax, I think, where the camera footage couldn't really be used because it was weak and wobbly rather than strong and stable. And so the footage of Theresa May was going on all over the place. Cabinet ministers weren't being consulted on the manifesto. So I think because of all that dysfunction, like the wheels would have fallen off at some point, and almost the wheels fell off because it was such a long campaign. In 1974, when there was a snap election by Wilson, I think, to get himself a majority, there was 21 days between the announcement of the election and the election being held. This time it was 7 weeks. And that was partly because they thought there'd be a problem with the Fixed Term Parliaments Act to get through. But that long campaign meant that you couldn't just repeat Strong and Stable and have Theresa May not doing TV debates. I get the impression that some disaster like the social care policy disaster would have happened, but also that Labour's campaign team were quite good at making their own look as well. So we've talked about the performance of Corbyn. Actually, I think Labour's response to the terrorist attacks and the focus on police funding, the fact that Corbyn came out and made a speech saying that but it was very controversial at the time, and saying that maybe Britain's foreign policy war on terror was in some way responsible. I think a few of us would be quite sceptical of that. But it's that kind of saying what he thinks, setting the mood, setting the discussion and focusing on police cuts that meant actually a lot of the Tory strategists think if the campaign had gone for two more weeks, actually they think that Labour might have won that election.
And I was really struck during that campaign about how many people went, oh, it's just like 1974, it'll be like 1974. It's a different country to 1974, it's a different world to 1974. So much had changed between those two. And I just don't think that a lot of people had really clocked the extent to which it had.
I think the other thing it shows is that how important leadership still is and perceptions of leadership in elections. The image of Theresa May that we had prior to the 8th of June, you know, this kind of second coming of Thatcher and, you know, strong, decisive, capable. And that was just so brutally exposed in the space of that 7 week campaign. And I think you probably would have seen a slightly different result if it had been somebody who was more capable of taking the fight to Labour than she exposed herself as being. You know, you can't run a campaign on the basis of I'm a strong and stable leader if you flip-flop over policy. You refuse to turn up to the debate. I mean, look, that was obviously, you don't, the advice that was supposed to play in the past was, well, you're so far ahead, you don't engage in the debate because you only lose out. Actually, I think once you've conceded that debates are part of an election campaign, you can't reverse on that. And if you're seeing that they're not turning up, you just look cowardly and weak and wobbly. So the importance of leadership, the collapse of her credibility as a leader, I think really drove into that campaign. And, you know, again, this came back to me on doorsteps. So at the start of the campaign, I was talking to a lot of people who had died in the wall Labour voters of many years standing, who were very, very positive about what they perceived Theresa May to be. You went back to those doorsteps 4 or 5 weeks later and you got a very different account of events. And in the meantime, Labour had been given the space to put a different interpretation across to that had been seen at the start of the campaign. And you can see how we ended up, or how the Tories ended up in that car crash.
I think the other thing is also about agenda setting. And then the Labour one came out, and it was leaked very cleverly. I'm not sure whether it was clever or not, the launch of it started to make the political weather. And after that, with the police cuts thing, which was, I mean, part of the reason why the police cuts thing was so good was because it was, you know, true. After the manifesto's launch, Labour was the one setting the agenda. And the Tories were then reacting to it.
The other thing just to mention is that because they were clearly on the agenda of we're going to sack the Chancellor after the landslide win, they didn't play the economy card. You know, you're keeping the Chancellor of the Exchequer away from the cameras, and therefore just not pushing any of the economic arguments in a way that would have played to their benefit, I think, if they'd been really focused on that.
I stood in for MPs a number of debates at the 2015 election, and I've long thought that the don't turn up, you've got more to lose idea. It's just an utter fantasy. The feedback I've had after every single one of those debates has been, yeah, I'd vote for you, but I'm not voting for the sucker who didn't turn up, which is sad but true. But on the second coming of Thatcher thing, it's just so much about our country again, I think, this one. Why was she seen as the second coming of Thatcher? She's the second woman ever to do it. That's the only reason why. And the flimsiness that we built up that image with as a nation was exposed instantly. Mm. And sad to say, I think there's a latent amount of sexism in there. A benign sexism, I have to say, just in the media assumption that she would be the same.
I think that's true. I think there is a certain amount of latent sexism there. But I also think Theresa May deliberately tried to position herself as the second coming of Thatcher. There was the point in PMQs when she deliberately dropped her voice and almost did an impression of Thatcher. And to say something like, remind you of anybody or something like that. So, I mean, she also went out of her way to try and portray herself as the second coming of Thatcher.
Whereas if I actually a proper Thatcherite would try and keep us in a single market.
There is that.
So let's look at the future, Steve. In the short term, I think the effects have been fairly obvious. And we've talked about them on the podcast. If you haven't heard us, subscribe. What do you think are the longer term consequences of this election?
So I think we've touched up on one of them already, which is like the impact of the internet, social media, and how that's seemingly now directly changing the way that political parties are going about some of their campaigning. But certainly across the medium term, the effectiveness of momentum from the Labour side is going to have an impact. You know, to what extent that is, because it's going to be determined. But they have demonstrated that, at least on some level, they are capable of doing something very, very well. Again, the digital stuff they're doing in terms of videos, adverts, basically mocking the Tories and Tory voters and things like that as a way to kind of rile up that Labour, a certain part of the Labour base, is very high quality and very well done. So there's that. Then you've also got the fact that we're seeing now the first kind of generation of MPs who are, for lack of a better term, almost like digitally enabled or kind of digital natives, your Jared O'Mara's, your Emma Dent Coates, who, when you dig around into their past, you find lots of things online that they've done and said, which, you know, a lot of them, and these two instances, aren't particularly very pleasant, and there's a lot of issues around those too. But you do have that generation of people who are going to have probably somewhere amongst their things, a forum post here or there, which could easily be taken out of context, could easily be form that the basis of a story. It might be a flimsy story, but it's a story nonetheless, and it's the sort of thing which a Greedo folks would happily run with.
I think that's a medium-term consequence, definitely, is I think it would have been a set, if you had a Tory landslide, it would have been similar, because CTHQ hadn't vetted their candidates, and certainly, I think about the Tory candidate in Selly Oak, if she would have become an MP, essentially on the back of the air war in the 25-point Tory lead, would have been an absolutely terrible MP. But I think you do have people like Emma Dent Coates who just shouldn't be MPs, essentially.
One of the other things that I think we'll see as a long-term consequence is the metropolitan-rural divide has always been there. And the small towns and suburban areas have sort of flipped between the two. Those small towns and suburban areas, places like Mansfield, Bolsover, which was the second biggest Tory swing in the country, just not quite enough to take Dennis Skinner out. But those places are starting to go bluer. And the metropolitan areas are going more and more red. So we'll start to see, you know, perhaps some of this sort of unseat Boris Johnson stuff. That might happen. Some of the London seats like that might start to go, as some of the seats around the South East, as people who are natural Labour voters in London move out of London because they can't afford it, might start to go more red. And then the North, or the rural areas, might start going more and more Tory. And you might end up with, you know, the kind of Democrats used to hold the South every single time, and it suddenly flipped and became the Republican stronghold of the United States. You could see something similar emerging or possibly happening here.
So I think Birmingham's an interesting study for that point. So if you look at areas that we've picked up, almost by surprise, over the last 7-8 years in the city, we've started picking up wards like Harborne, which was traditionally true blue. We've picked up Sutton Vesey, okay, 1 out of 3, but still the People's Republic. Places like Handsworth Wood, there are places that more mirror the south of England in terms of demographic. than they do other parts of Birmingham that we are picking up that we wouldn't have expected to before. And part of the reason for that is higher earning public sector people moving into those areas who have a public sector, appreciate the public sector, work in the public sector, and vote Labour because of our track record on the public sector. And I wonder if we're starting to see that mirrored nationally. So in Birmingham, again, we've lost seats like King Sandown and Erdington, which are your more working class areas that would have traditionally been us, just in exactly the same way as look, nationally, we're losing those areas. Part of me wants if it comes back to the poor people get poor public services. Sad truth.
I think possibly also the election, partly because of Brexit, partly because of the incompetence of UKIP and the Dems, saw a... And partly because of tactical voting, because of our rubbish voting system, we saw a return to two-party politics. Now, I think in the medium to long term, both parties' voting coalitions are screwed. I mean, yes, we've talked at length about the problems of Labour's voting coalition. However, if there is a Tory version of this podcast in a Conservative nuclear bunker, they're probably thinking, dear God, we don't have a majority of any voters under 45. Well, what do we do in elections in 5 or 10 years' time if, as you rightly said at the start of the podcast, LJ, if those reasons why people become more conservative with the small C anyway as they get older, if those things don't hold true, actually their voting coalition is anything more screwed than ours?
Yeah, and this is actually where, you know, you don't have to say this, where Nick Timothy was probably technically correct to look to try and...
Get out.
I know, to try and redefine what conservatism actually is of it being a bit more focused on those working class areas and things like that would have been very beneficial to the Conservatives over the long term. Mm. And the problem I think they're going to have is that the only people who are really making that case was Nick Timothy. And Nick Timothy's turned out to be not very competent and no one's making that case anymore. And so they're going to end up just struggling to define themselves in a way that will actually appeal to the voters that they've now lost.
Yeah, I mean, there was a huge opportunity for them to seize that ground. I'm just, like you, not convinced that there's anybody, not only behind the scenes, but front of house, to provide the political leadership to now attack that space. Mm-hmm. I think as you see this government increasingly sink into the morass of Brexit and incompetence, I think perhaps that moment for them to seize that ground has gone.
My concern with that is also... There's not that many. There's a few. There's David Lammy, Lisa Nandy, Liam Byrne, John Chris, making that case on the Labour side, but they're voices in the wilderness. And my concern is, if you sort of read Richard Rorty, Achieving Our Country, and he sort of talks about, you've got two middle-class parties now, and then the working class starts looking for a strong man because they're being screwed by everyone. And that's what led to Donald Trump. And I fear... We could be heading towards a very similar situation here.
So Nick Timothy was right all along and Britain's going to go fascist. That is your end takeaway from this Not Enough Champagne review of British politics.
Merry Christmas, everyone.
That's it for now. Our website is notenoughchampagne.com. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. LJ's already opening the wine. because we're about to talk about Donald Trump. Our theme tune is Booking Good Times by Dave Deffer, and our logo is designed by James Cram. LJ, what's your Twitter handle before you get drunk?
LJ Davies 87, Davies with an E.
Mine is Paperback Writer.
Mine is @CinderRadical.
@Bridget Jones.
@Councillor John Cotton.
Happy plotting, everyone.